tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss a special support project for persons subjected to ICE deportations.
Our guest, Andrea Vasquez from the CUNY Teachers Union, tells us about their court watching program.
We then speak with Professor Zachary Wolf, editor of the legal treatise, Hate Crime Law.
As hate-fuel attacks are on the rise, we examine whether hate crime laws are being used to protect people or to police speech. Stay with us.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
In New York City, a quiet act of resistance takes place every week inside the federal immigration courts. Members of the Professional Staff Congress, the union representing faculty and staff across the City University of New York, have been showing up not as lawyers or law enforcement, but rather as witnesses. They call themselves court watchers. Their goal, to stand beside immigrants facing possible deportation, to document abuses, and to assert the public's right to observe what happens inside these halls of power. The union's Immigrant Solidarity Working Group launched this effort over the summer after reports that armed ICE agents were making mass arrests in and around federal courthouses, even detaining people who had appeared voluntarily for hearings. For many PSC members, this was a line they couldn't ignore. Each Friday morning in Foley Square, educators gather before entering the courthouse. They're trained to document what they see, to provide moral support, and to help loved ones locate those taken into detention. Their presence sends a message that New Yorkers will not turn away from injustice carried out in their name. What began as an act of witness has become a form of civic education. Teachers who spend their days in classrooms are now learning new lessons about power, vulnerability, and courage. In the process, they're showing their students and the city what solidarity looks like in action. Joining us today is PSC Secretary Andrea Vasquez. Andrea is an associate director of the American Social History Project at the CUNY Graduate Center and a managing director of the New Media Lab. Andrea, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You said that, quote, we must exercise our legal rights if we're to retain them, and we must organize if we're to face future challenges. What first inspired PSC members to begin observing immigration court hearings?
Well, I would say that as soon as we heard about what was going on in the courts right here, actually near our union headquarters, we thought that our members would care about this. We are a social justice union of 30,000 members, so we not only take care of the normal things that unions do, our good contracts and health and safety on the job, but we care very much about our students, our hundreds of thousands of students, most of whom are people of color. A large number are non-citizens, come from immigrant families. So we care about the communities we serve and the students we serve. And we fight around all kinds of issues that are important to our members. So when we heard what was going on in the courtrooms, we wrote to our members. We wrote a big message, and in no time we heard back that people wanted to do something and have be present in the courtrooms as soon as we heard that ICE was present in what was supposed to be, you know, regular routine hearings for immigrant families.
Well, how did the federal government's policy shift this summer change conditions inside New York's immigration courts?
Well, we began going to the courts in late May, I think, and we decided to go every Friday. You know, everything we did was legal. We have a right to observe in courtrooms. We have a right to enter the buildings and talk to who we want to in the court, in the buildings. And we were able to exercise those rights. Of course, if a judge says no talking in a courtroom, which they usually do, we don't talk in a courtroom. But we have the right to enter, be legal observers. And we were allowed to do that. And judges would ask us who we are when we came into the courtroom. And we could stay there and talk to people in the waiting room and do what we wanted to do. As the summer went by, it became clear that there were more and more restrictions on where we could situate ourselves and with whom we could speak. And that's when it just got a whole lot worse in July and in August. And now here we are in October. And when you think it just can't get more tense and more difficult to exercise your rights, it has. There are all kinds of restrictions being put on us in those spaces.
Well, speaking of restrictions, do volunteers receive training before they begin watching? And do you continue to educate them about what they're not allowed to do as measures, as it gets stricter inside?
Well, we always, even from the beginning when there were, you know, fewer restrictions, we required that all of our members attend a training with us. There are many other organizations, I should say, who are doing this work and who were doing it even before we were earlier. And of course, there are many immigration organizations who've been doing this for decades. So we learned from others, and we entered this with great humility and did a lot of, as other people did, a lot of Know Your Rights trainings, and because we were in immigrant communities and our students were immigrants. Some of our faculty members are international, on international visas and things. So we had to educate ourselves, as did many others. So we do require that all of our members attend a training with us. And I think in other organizations, they also train people before they go into the courthouses. And we spend a good amount of time with people going over what we're doing, explaining what we're doing and how it's all legal, and yet also explaining how difficult it can be, especially nowadays. But we do feel that, you know, we have a right to be there. We need to exercise these rights, and we need to follow rules. And we always say we are 100% nonviolent, and we are not there to interfere with ICE or to confront ICE or to disrupt ICE. We are there to help immigrant families and individuals. That's what our focus is. And so that's what we learn, how to talk to people and how to be kind and see if people want assistance in any way that we can help them. And sometimes we walk people out of the building and sometimes we follow up afterwards. But we're not interested in confrontation or violence or interrupting or, you know, we're there just to help fellow New Yorkers. We go through a lot of things in the trainings, but that's really the main point, is we keep our focus on the people we're there to help and always do what's in their best interest.
Can you describe what it feels like to walk through the courthouse hallways when they're lined with armed and masked ICE agents?
It's really horrible. I'm a small person. I'm 5 feet tall. And many of the families and women who come with children are my size. And it's threatening. It's intimidating, and I have to tell myself that I have a right to be here, and I'm doing the right thing, and I won't be bullied out of it. And that's what and I don't look at them, I don't look them in the eye, I don't respond. I mean, in the beginning I did a little bit, but now I'm just, in fact, so contemptuous of what they're doing and what these individuals have chosen to do for a living, that I don't pay attention to that. I'm there with another purpose. what they're doing and what they represent is just a truly evil and harmful practice and policies and beliefs. And I, as a native New Yorker, you know, citizen my whole life, I'm just ashamed of what's happening in our city. I'm ashamed of what our government is doing. And I try to show humanity to the people I'm trying to help. And I want them to see, I want to be of help if I can, but I also want people to see that ICE doesn't represent us. ICE doesn't represent what New Yorkers feel. We are in a city of immigrants, historically, a beautiful city of immigrants, and we need our immigrants in New York City. We benefit from the diversity of this city, historically and in the present. So I think we just have to deal with their presence right now, hope it ends soon, and hope we can bring our city back into shape.
So well said, Andrea. Would you mind sharing any particular incident or interaction you witnessed that has lingered with you?
Well, there are so many. I've gone almost every week since May and have many of our members, and we've all seen just horrible scenes. We also know that what we are experiencing is nothing compared to what immigrant families and our community members are feeling and experiencing, but we feel it with them. And we try to sit close to people when we can, and people grab our hands and they let us hold them, you know, arm in arm when we walk out together. So people have shared their most frightening and vulnerable time of their life, some of the scariest days of children's lives. And people are opening up to us and welcoming any kind of support that they can get. So that is, it's a privilege in a way, and it's humbling for us. And it's an honor to sort of be able to help people and show that that we're there with them, and we want to be there with them, and we want their life to get better, and we want New York and this country to live up to its promise. So it's all of that is an honor. It is. I've been with a family, and there were three kids and a pregnant wife and a husband, and I stayed with them with others for hours. And ICE, just the numbers grew and grew outside of the courtroom, and the judge would not let us in the courtroom. So, I mean, I stood outside with others between a, you know, huge security guard and a huge ICE agent right with me, right by the door, because I wanted to be able to see them. And then, you know, 10 feet away, there were another 15 ICE agents and another 15 press photographers. And I waited for a long time. I don't remember exactly how long it was. And people kept leaving, and ICE would either take people or they wouldn't take people. And when the family left, ICE didn't leave. So they hadn't gotten who they were waiting for. And I felt certain that they were waiting for this father. And when they came out, the father was holding his four-year-old, who was fast asleep in his arms. And there was an older, a teenage girl, and she was with the younger sister and the pregnant wife. And I put my arm around this man, which is an odd thing to do, but I just felt protective of, as he was protecting his child, I didn't want anything to happen to him. And it just was natural for me. I'm a mother and a grandmother. And I put my arm around him and walked out through this just tunnel of horrible, large, armed, vested, masked ICE agents. And perhaps because there were many of us surrounding this family, or because there were many photographers by then, you never know why they take one person and not another. And I would like, I hope we had played some part in allowing this beautiful family to leave the courtroom and the court building safely that day. And they did. And when we left, all of us were in tears together. We walked them to the subway with a couple of young men who were there as court watchers also. I don't know them. We had been prepped in advance. I knew their first name maybe, and we're just, these perfect strangers had just this moment where we were all so grateful to each other and so happy together. And then I found out that the young woman had just attended an orientation. She was about to begin one of our CUNY colleges. So here was a family that could have been destroyed that day. I don't know how many of these folks, how many of the family were, you know, were there for their hearing, or if it was just one or the whole family. But it just made me realize what is held in the balance for families that are every day have to live with the fear of a raid. But to go into this immigration courthouse and not know if you're going to walk out with your family intact. And it just showed me how much future this child, this young person, has such a future. She's going to come to our public university where we have, you know, faculty and programs that can help her and her whole family. You know, for generations to come, it makes a difference when you have a college education. And that could have just been lost. And that's happened hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times in the city over these past months. And that's just such a shame. It's such a loss for our city. It's such a loss for the future of so many young people. That was just a day I will never, ever forget.
Well, how do court watchers, including yourself, balance the emotional toll of feeling helpless at times with the sense of purpose that you mentioned in showing up?
Well, I mean, I don't feel that we can say we're winning this battle in the courtrooms. Although I will say, I think in every nook and cranny, every large and small neighborhood, every block, building, and boulevard in this city, people are starting to organize in small and large organizations and in unions. And that's how you fight helplessness. You fight helplessness by organizing and doing what you can. Not everyone could or should be in the courtrooms. You have to be in good physical shape. You have to be in good emotional shape. And, you know, if you're not a citizen, I wouldn't suggest you want to bring yourself into that building. But everyone can do something. And people are. People are doing that all across the city. Community defense groups, helping people who are afraid to go out, escorting children. There are just so many ways, you know, belonging to an organization that's doing this work. There are many, many. And they are can be small, community-based, maybe national-based or ethnic-based organizations, or they can be large immigration organizations or our labor unions. I mean, there are places for activism right now, and we need it because of what's happening in the courts, and we need it because of the threat of federal troops invading our city. And that's what people are rising up, and that really is the antidote to helplessness or depression or I don't hear apathy anywhere. People care. But you know, there's nothing more that this administration wants is than to instill fear in all of us by standing together, by having actions and demonstrations and joyous things together. That's how we will take care of ourselves to continue this fight until we win.
Andrea, why is it especially important for educators to take part in this kind of action? And do many of them speak about it, to your knowledge, in classrooms?
Well, I mean, you know, in the courts, we're fighting for due process for immigrant families, and they deserve that, and that's what they're supposed to get in the Constitution. As educators, we come into contact, and our faculty members have the privilege of teaching our wonderful students in New York City. This is the largest public urban university system in the nation. So we have 250,000 students who are degree seeking, and another 200,000 who are in all kinds of other programs. So our university is just a part of the essence of what this city is. It's a wonderful institution, and we're fighting to keep it that way. We're fighting to defend our democracy, not just do this court work. And I don't mean just in, you know, there's so many things we need to fight about right now. But as educators, we believe that providing a real education to our students is crucial. And that means that faculty have the right to decide what they teach in their classes. They have the right to teach it in the way they want to teach it. And these things are being threatened right now. So I think educators from kindergarten through college are all concerned about what we can continue to offer our students. I mean, the Department of Education being dismantled, intrusions into higher education in all kinds of ways are threatening public education. So faculty include what's relevant in their classes. I mean, students, there are all kinds of things that happen at a university. It all doesn't happen in a classroom. There are plenty of student organizations where students are active, and clubs, and sort of all kinds of extracurricular things, right? So faculty, it depends on the class, whether they're talking about this or not, and it depends on the teacher, but they certainly, you know, should be allowed to if it's relevant to what they're doing during their course. But otherwise, students have plenty of ways to participate. And right now, there's also a big voter registration drive going on. We have so many young people who can vote for the first time now, and we're trying to encourage them to vote in this mayoral election. So there's a lot going on in the city right now.
Well, how does this work, including the court-watching work, connect to the broader fight against authoritarianism and the rising tide of fascism that some members of the Professional Staff Congress mention?
These things are very connected, and that's why I guess I've mentioned a few of them already. The fight in the courts is about due process, which is a right. The fight in the classrooms for academic freedom and the freedom to teach and learn as one is supposed to for one's class is connected. The right to free speech and to demonstrate and to protest. One does not need to agree with language that someone uses or a cause, but we have a right to protest. We have a right to speak out. We have to defend those rights. And so they're being challenged in the courtrooms, they're being challenged in the university, and they're being challenged in the streets. So these things are very related. And in workplaces, I mean, our union doesn't have as many immigrant workers or undocumented workers as some other unions might have, but there's a crossover between what happens in the workplace, what happens in our communities, and what happens in our schools, what happens in our hospitals. We need to protect these spaces, and instead of spending $150 billion on ICE or the National Guard, that money needs to be in education. That money needs to be in healthcare. Instead, the money is being robbed, really, from working people, and it's being handed over to the rich. That's what's happening right now. So these things are, there's intersections everywhere for workers, regardless of citizen status, for young people, regardless of citizen status. So that's why the work of coalition is just burgeoning right now. So many groups are working together to support each other, to support each other's constituencies, and realize that we're all in this together. And we have a new group in New York called Hands Off New York, which is really going to resist the deployment of federal troops in our city. We do not have a crisis with crime, and neither did the other cities that were invaded. New York, we say, traditionally is a union town, and we take care of each other in unions. So we plan to stand up for our rights in New York, and we don't need the intrusion of outside troops here.
Well said. I'm curious, has the union had any repercussions from the administration? Has there been backlash or criticism at all?
From our own college administration, you mean?
Right.
I would say no. I mean, we have our disagreements on various things that they've done, but in terms of supporting immigrant students, you know, we're on the same page in wanting our students to be free to learn. We are on the same page with wanting to provide resources for students, faculty, and staff. Earlier back in the spring, we had a petition aimed at our university, and we had more than 7,000 signatures saying, you know, we need you to provide more. And they did succeed in doing some fundraising, and they now have a rapid response program, and they're providing more legal support for students, faculty, and staff. So in many important ways, we're on the same page. There are other things that we are in disagreement about, and we deal with those struggles, but it isn't primarily about protecting students.
What kind of legislative or policy changes are you and your colleagues calling for at the city or state level?
At the state level, there's a bill called New York for All, and that would provide supports and protection for immigrants. So we are very much in favor of that bill. And at the city level, there's a similar bill called New York City Trust Act. So those are the two pieces of legislation that we actually just had a big demonstration, and that was those. They were one of the demands in the demonstration, was to call the state legislators back into session to pass New York for All and the city to pass New York City Trust Act.
Andrea, I'm still thinking of your comment that New York is a union city. And I wonder, how has court watching built solidarity within the CUNY union itself?
Well, what became very clear to me early back in June and July, May and June, was that so many people who were coming, who were union members, were coming to trainings, were people I had never seen at a demonstration. People who said they had never come to a union meeting before. People who did not call themselves activists necessarily. So this spoke to people. This issue and the harm that was being done to our students' families and in our neighborhoods spoke to members. And so it really built. Other thing is, people who are not even able to do this work, people I don't even know, write messages and say, I'm so proud of what the union's doing, and I wish I could do it. And just out of the blue, we send messages, emails to people about one thing, and they write back and they say they're so proud of this. So it has galvanized people and given people, I think, a pride and a feeling of solidarity. It's different. You know, we made a very big point early on of doing this as a union, in the name of our union. Our members could have gone out with various other groups any day of the week and gone into the courthouses. They're choosing to do it with their union. And in fact, I have just finished training staff members in a few other New York City unions because other unions want to do the same thing. And I'm sure other union members are doing it, but not in the name of their union. So I think that's the difference, and I think it made people very proud and feeling very a great feeling of solidarity in this union town to be doing this. And I'm very happy that other unions will be doing this and will be joining another campaign, which is called Hands Off New York, which is about keeping the troops out of New York. That will include many, many unions, and I think it will build broad union solidarity in New York City.
Andrea, unfortunately, we've run out of time. It's been really a pleasure to hear about the court-watching program by the union at CUNY. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, you can always visit our union website. It's psc-cuny.org. And the new website and campaign that got launched today is called handsoffnyc.com. That's the website. So I think those are probably the best ways right now to follow what we're doing.
If our listeners are inspired, which I think many will be, to join in on the Hands Off New York campaign, is that something they can do?
Absolutely. This is going to be, I think there are Hands Off campaigns in many cities. So I think people, as I said earlier, we all need to do something and we all can do something. And there are Hands Off campaigns all across the country. So I hope they do join in one way or another.
Andrea, thank you so much for being with us, and keep up the amazing work. It's really inspirational.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Across the country, tensions are high as hate-fueled incidents make headlines almost daily. Just last month, a transgender woman in Washington State was assaulted by a mob yelling transphobic slurs while one attacker choked her. In this charged environment, politicians are weighing in, some pledging to crack down, others blurring the line between hateful speech and protected expression. The Trump administration formed a federal task force to combat anti-Semitism and is targeting universities across the nation. Attorney General Pam Bondi has said the Department of Justice will target and, quote-unquote, go after individuals who threaten others with hate speech. But what does it mean when political figures invoke hate crime laws as tools of ideology rather than justice? And what are the real implications for free speech, civil rights, and public safety? To help us sort through it all, we're joined by George Washington University professor Zachary J. Wolfe, editor of Hate Crimes Law, and a leading scholar on how the United States defines, prosecutes, and debates hate-motivated offenses. He's here to help us understand how these laws are being used, and sometimes misused, in today's polarized climate. Zach, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Let's start with the basics. How do hate crime laws actually work? What must prosecutors prove? And where do they often fall short?
Crucially, first there has to be a criminal offense. And then there has to be demonstration that it was motivated by bias against a protected group. So the United States does not have hate speech laws, only hate crime laws. Many hate crimes work essentially as sentencing enhancements for activity that's already criminalized. And that might seem a little strange, but we do this outside the context of hate crimes as well. Murder that was motivated by genocide or terrorism, or in order to silence a witness, or murder for hire, anything like that is going to be treated more severely than a murder that was undertaken in the heat of passion or was unintentional due to reckless behavior. So hate speech and hate crime enhancements laws are sort of in that vein. You can almost think of it in some ways as a reaction to a time before when many jurisdictions recognized something like a gay panic defense, where a person could actually get a lesser offense or be found not guilty because they thought a person of the same sex was hitting on them. So hate crime laws can in some ways be seen as sort of a corrective to that. I would also note that, you know, we recognize that anyone can be a victim of a crime for any number of reasons, but there's something sort of more horrible and more terrorizing to the community when you're targeted because of who you are. So the second thing that a prosecutor needs to prove beyond the fact that there was an underlying crime is that the crime was motivated by bias against a protected characteristic, race, religion, sex or gender, sexuality, typically.
Zach, we keep hearing that hate crimes are on the rise. Do the numbers actually support that? And what is behind the increase? More incidents or better reporting?
It's hard to know for certain because reporting is unreliable and it varies greatly by jurisdiction. So the uniform crime reports include crimes reported by local jurisdictions, law enforcement agencies, as being motivated by bias, but that's highly politicized. Alabama never has hate crimes, right? California has a lot of hate crimes if you go by the numbers that are in the UCRs. We can, however, identify historical trends of increase in both the number of hate groups that are operating in the United States as well as hate crimes. And that seems to be an increase in hate crime seem to be motivated both by when there are particular groups facing broader social stigma, like anti-immigrant rhetoric, but also when there is a sort of political development of a historically discriminated against group having social advancements or legal advancements. So after the Obergefell decision required recognition of same-sex marriage, there was an uptick in sexually orientation-motivated hate crimes. After Obama's election, there was an uptick in race-motivated hate crimes as well. So we know that this stuff is happening on a sort of broader societal level. The exact numbers we can't clearly document because of the uncertain and politically biased reporting.
Well, Zach, what barriers keep victims from reporting hate crimes, especially in marginalized communities that may mistrust law enforcement?
So certainly the mistrust of law enforcement is the primary barrier. It's too early for data about what has been happening under the Trump administration most recently, but you have to suspect that immigrants are more reluctant lately to be reporting when they are victims of crime or witnesses to crime, and especially in sanctuary jurisdictions, as more and more of those sanctuary jurisdictions are now dropping their policies. It used to be law enforcement, cities had policies in sanctuary jurisdictions that they would not cooperate with immigration authorities, they would not automatically report when someone is undocumented and is the victim or a witness of a crime. So jurisdictions are beginning to drop those, or they're finding themselves effectively unable to enforce them. Again, this is at least one group that you have to imagine is having a heightened mistrust of law enforcement and willingness to participate in the criminal justice process.
Zach, we know that the First Amendment protects even hateful opinions. How do we draw the line between protected expression and criminal conduct when bias or threats are involved?
Yeah. So this is an important question, and it's one where, on the one hand, it's very difficult to do, and on the other hand, it's a standard thing that courts do all the time. So how do we draw the line? We draw it in largely the same way that we do with other laws that punish people differently depending on motive. And we often determine that motive based on the defendant's speech. So what was I talking about with a murder for hire or murder that's motivated by desire to silence a witness? Those kinds of things are often proven through a defendant's speech. It gets more complicated, particularly when the crime is something like stalking or a true threat, where it's the speech itself that's involved. But again, those acts are criminalized even without a bias indicator. Even if it's not a hate crime, there's still prosecutions for true threats or stalking that's primarily accomplished through speech. So at some point, speech crosses the line into unprotected conduct, whether it's motivated by hate or not. And that's not always clear, but we do have some fairly recent Supreme Court cases, quite recent, Counterman v. Colorado, and one a few years ago, Alanis versus United States, that dealt with the challenge of online posts and how to demonstrate criminality. The argument is that when the way people talk online is different, and so it's can be more difficult to identify when it is a true threat for stalking. And so courts are going to have to grapple with those new standards, but again, that's something that courts have been doing for a long time. And just to note, it gets more complicated still when we're talking about civil issues, either someone suing in a civil lawsuit, or if there's a question of eligibility for government funding. So things like sexual harassment or racially hostile work or educational environments, those aren't exactly hate crimes, but it still sort of comes into that question of the line between political expression and conduct that can be sanctioned either criminally or through a civil process. And again, there are issues of where the line is and more often how to prove it. And then if it's a public school or a government employee there, we get even more First Amendment issues in those kinds of civil cases.
Well, Zach, as a quick follow-up, is it that online communications are allowed to be more hyperbolic, for example, or can you just summarize what some of the differences are?
So the court has said that we need to look more closely at the motive of the defendant, and it's that there needs to be a standard of recklessness, that they engage in speech with reckless disregard of whether that person would feel threatened or stalked.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Pam Bondi's remarks that the government is targeting universities as part of fighting quote-unquote anti-Semitism. The Department of Justice has launched investigations into alleged anti-Semitic harassment on campuses. Are these genuine civil rights enforcement efforts or more political theater?
So it appears to be essentially cover for another political agenda. There's a really helpful resource from the Chronicle on Higher Education. You can Google tracking Trump's higher ed deals. and it offers essentially a close reading of the settlements from Department of Justice and various institutions that have settled those investigations. And it shows that there is really very little interest in anti-Semitism, almost no provisions concerning anti-Semitism. On the other hand, there are lots of provisions concerning what the administration, Trump administration, calls DEI practices, focusing on student admissions, hiring and promotion of faculty and staff. That seems to be the primary motive based on what they are accepting as settlements for these investigations. You know, colleges have to prize both the free exchange of ideas and teaching students how to confront positions that make them uncomfortable, as well as how do we teach civil discourse, how to create a community that makes that truly possible. And students and faculty are taking that seriously. I see this in my university all the time. The fear of legal action isn't helping us to engage in that educational endeavor.
Interesting, Zach. I was at an event at Columbia University last night, which most people from New York will remember was once an open campus, but we had to show pre-authorized codes to be admitted into the main area, which was a change.
I'm going to respond to that. That's something that a number of private universities are doing to make clear that it is a closed campus and therefore law enforcement needs a warrant to be able to enter.
Oh, so correct. I forgot about that. Zach, while anti-Semitism is in the spotlight, we're still seeing spikes in anti-Black, anti-LGBTQ+, and anti-Muslim attacks. Are prosecutors and lawmakers treating all forms of hate equally?
So that's something that's going to vary tremendously by jurisdiction. Most hate crime prosecutions, really like most criminal prosecutions in general, happen at the state level. So we would need to look on sort of state-by-state attention to hate crimes against those groups. Certainly at the federal level, we haven't heard much from Department of Justice about concern for hate crimes against the groups that you mentioned.
How can we prevent hate crime laws from being used selectively to target certain political or religious groups while ignoring others?
So I think that there has to be a political response as well as a legal one. On the law side, there are standards for malicious prosecution. Much of that's going to be tested by James Comey, and it's going to be very much a part of the news cycle over the coming months. And there's a requirement for the underlying crime that we discuss. All those things serve as protections for overuse and misuse of hate crime laws. But a lot of it is going to come down to who is in charge of those prosecutor offices, which is often a political question.
Zach, as you referred to briefly earlier, much of today's hate speech is spreading digitally, from doxing to AI-generated propaganda and even more AI-related efforts. Are the current laws capable of addressing online hate? Are they antiquated? Or are we really in uncharted territory now?
Yeah, so I think it's really a bit of both. The contours of what constitutes a hate crime doesn't depend on how that crime is affected. But identifying the responsible party, especially, gets much harder when it's online. We know outside the crime context, we know that AI has a tendency to discriminate. There's a article from last year that published in Nature. AI generates covertly racist decisions about people based on their dialect. And it was reveals that depending on who the AI has determined you likely are, if you're a person of color or a white person, if you upload identical resumes and ask for recommendations about what kinds of jobs should I apply for, it will recommend either executive level or lower paid hourly wage positions to apply for, depending on who it thinks you are, based on how it's picked up on the dialect that you use. law is trying to respond to this to some extent. Earlier this year, New Jersey issued guidance on algorithmic discrimination that sort of noted the tendency of AI to be discriminatory and the continuing application of their existing laws against discrimination, state laws against discrimination, and was sort of trying to note that employers and housing providers and mortgage providers, everyone covered by public accommodation laws, has an obligation to ensure that their decision-making isn't based on unlawful discrimination. To extend that to the crime context, I mean, you have to imagine it's only a matter of time before a chatbot commits stalking or issues a true threat or something else that might be a hate crime, whether it was sort of deliberately designed to do so or just because that's the way the chatbots seem to be educating themselves from the internet. So those kinds of questions, I think, are going to be much more difficult to grapple with. And even if we say, yes, that's clearly a crime, trying to figure out who is responsible for that.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Law and Disorder. I'm Maria Hall here with my co-host, Heidi Boghossian. We're speaking with Zachary J. Wolfe, editor of Hate Crimes Law and a leading scholar on how the United States defines, prosecutes, and debates hate-motivated offenses. Well, Zach, how do we balance fighting hate speech with preserving free expression, especially on college campuses where academic freedom is at stake?
And so this is what the university is for, and this is what students and faculty work on throughout their careers and throughout their time at the university. So really we need to make it possible for students and faculty to teach and learn on the substance of those discussions, those discussions that need that kind of free exchange of ideas, as well as on sort of functional questions of how do we create a community that both prizes the free exchange of ideas, but is also respectful. And there are lines where a hostile educational environment can be created that makes full participation in the life of the university impossible. And when that happens, administrators as well as faculty and staff need to be vigilant, ensuring that that never happens. It's quickly corrected if it is. But you know, the fear of a politically motivated government investigation and politically motivated governmental actions can also make it impossible for students to feel and be fully able to participate in that educational experience.
Zach, I understand that other democracies like Germany or Canada have stricter hate speech laws than the United States. What can or can't we learn from these countries?
So I think it is important to note that other democracies, other progressive democracies, view the limits of speech very differently than we do. Probably the most significant or useful example of this is genocide denial laws, saying that the Holocaust didn't happen, or other attempts to rewrite the history of genocide. Not just Nazi Germany, but other kinds of those laws apply to other genocides since then in other countries. So I think the main thing that we can sort of take from that is recognizing that there are multiple ways to think about the role of speech and what constitutes legitimate expression.
You're referring, I assume, to the Armenian genocide, where Turkey bans discussion of it.
Yes, exactly. Also the Rwandan genocide.
Yes.
Well, Zach, can you also explain the difference, in elementary terms, of the difference between civil laws that protect individuals against hate crimes or other similar offenses and the criminal law system?
So obviously there are different standards of proof and different actors who initiate it, right? So criminal law is guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and has to flow from specific statutes, criminal statutes, initiated by a prosecutor's office, whereas a civil action, is preponderance of the evidence, can be initiated by the victims of the act, or their legal representatives. I think that maybe a useful example is out of the Charlottesville Unite the Right demonstration action, where there was some criminal prosecution of the individual who drove the car and killed Heather Heyer. I think there were possibly other prosecutions. I know that one at least included a hate crime enhancement. There was also broad civil litigation brought against the groups that had helped to organize the protest, the event, as well as some of the individual organizers that relied upon a variety of civil statutes as well as common law, and was able to sort of gather broader evidence and seek broader results from that. And they did have a sort of historic jury verdict as a result of that.
Zach, I've wanted to ask you a question about how you put together hate crimes law. Do you do purely legal updates? Is it on an annual basis? And is there any room, because we know the law lags so often, the fast speed of political developments, is there any room for commentary by you in this publication?
There is some. It's more, it's meant to be a objective summary and assessment of where the law is right now. So primarily I'm looking at significant prosecutions, any new legislative reforms, if there's civil cases, that's part of it as well. But part of it is also assessing sort of where the advocacy is right now and how that advocacy appears to be influencing or not influencing, being resisted by the judicial system and legislators.
Well, if you could recommend one or two key policy changes right now, what would most improve hate crime enforcement or prevention, especially as technology, politics, and polarization continue to evolve?
I think it really is about a cultural embrace of being thoughtful about the lines, encouraging free speech, but also respect for each other, and respect for each other that is not even legally required, right? We need to get to back to a level of civility. We need a government that respects that this is, in almost every instance, a question for the speakers to figure out on their own, for the community to figure out what kind of community we need to build, whether that's at a university or other environment. And then a government that respects that and truly focuses on where something crosses the line into a crime. So certainly there are such instances, and the government has plenty to do focusing on true threats, violence, property destruction, without getting into prosecutions and investigations that lead people to be fearful of being able to have the free exchange of ideas.
Zach, how can our listeners follow you or learn more about the work that you're doing?
Both social media, I'm there as Prof. Z. Wolf, P-R-O-F-Z, like Zachary, W-O-L-F-E. ProfZWolf.com is my blog. You can also follow me on Blue Sky, ProfZWolf.BlueSky, and on the Fediverse, I am Prof. Z. Wolf at ESQ.social.
Well, Prof. Z. Wolf, it's been an honor to have you on today. once again, and we look forward to staying in touch about emerging issues related to hate crimes. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a great conversation.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we recognize the effort by countries worldwide established in the United Nations to put an end to war.
We talk with international law attorney Marjorie Cohn about that and her recent article entitled, As the UN Turns 80, Trump Continues U.S. Violation of Charter's Limits on the Use of Force. We then take a look at Trump's efforts to eliminate the one black woman from the Federal Reserve Board.
Our guest is Sharon Kyle, the publisher of the L.A. Progressive. We talk with her about the dismantling of U.S. agencies, as outlined in her article, Lisa Cook is low-hanging fruit, while Jerome Powell is a bridge too far.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. 80 years ago, after two world wars claimed millions of lives, nations around the world, including the United States, came together and established the UN system to, and I quote, save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. The UN Charter requires that all states settle their disputes peacefully and refrain from the use of armed force, except in self-defense after an armed attack against a UN state by another state, or when the Security Council authorizes it. But, motivated by American exceptionalism, the notion that the U.S. is unique and morally superior and thus not bound by the rules, successive U.S. governments have violated the commands of the U.N. Charter and illegally attacked other countries with impunity. Trump has ignored the straightforward rules about the lawful use of force, but he is not the first U.S. president to do so. The last five presidents have launched armed attacks without Security Council approval against countries that had not carried out any armed attacks on the U.S. or other U.N. member countries. Besides violating the Charter's prohibition on the use of force, the U.S. government, under both Biden and Trump, has aided and abetted Israel's commission of genocide in Gaza. As the number of Palestinians killed by Israel exceeds 66,000, and famine has reached the catastrophic phase, thousands of taxpayers across the country have united with Palestinian Americans to file an international legal complaint against the U.S. government for funding Israel's genocide in Gaza. An initial petition was filed in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in May by Taxpayers Against Genocide and the National Lawyers Guild. It charged the U.S. with aiding and abetting Israel in genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Tomorrow, the petitioners will file a new petition with the commission. It includes substantial evidence of the U.S. role in Israel's campaign of starvation. With us today to explain how successive U.S. presidents have violated the U.N. Charter and also to detail that petition against genocide that will be filed on October 7th in the International American Human Rights Commission is Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie Cohn is Professor Emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, Dean of the People's Academy of International Law, and former President of the National Lawyers Guild. She is a legal political analyst who does commentary and writes columns on Truthout and other outlets. She is also former host on Law and Disorder Radio. Her most recent book is Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie Cohn wrote an article published last week on Truthout about U.S. violations of the U.N. Charter.
Marjorie Cohn, a hearty, warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you, Michael and Jim.
Well, it's really nice to have you back, Marjorie. Let's start with Bill Clinton, who bombed Iraq and Kosovo and played a sinister role in the Rwanda genocide.
Yes, well, Bill Clinton actually could have helped prevent the genocide in Rwanda, but instead he kept the UN from acting to stop the killing of 800,000 people. And in 1993, Clinton bombed Iraq to retaliate for an assassination attempt against George H.W. Bush. in 1998 on the eve of his impeachment in order to distract attention away from it, Bill Clinton once again bombed Iraq, ostensibly to enforce Security Council resolutions, even though only the council has the power to enforce its resolutions. Both of those bombings violated the UN Charter. They weren't done in self-defense or with permission of the Security Council. And then in 1999, Clinton led the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia, which also violated the Charter, killing about 500 civilians. Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, called the UN a tool of American foreign policy.
Well, Marjorie, how about George Bush, George W. Bush? He invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. He was responsible, was he not, for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Afghans and Iraqis?
That's true, Jim. And, you know, at the time, many people were saying, well, Bush's invasion of Iraq was illegal, but it was perfectly justifiable for him to invade Afghanistan after 9/11, and that is just false. In 2001, even though Afghanistan had not attacked the United States, Bush illegally invaded that country in retaliation for September 11, 2001, where 19 men, 15 of whom came from Saudi Arabia, committed crimes against humanity in the United States. But that was not an armed attack by another state sufficient to trigger the Charter's Article 51 self-defense provision. It was not self-defense. The Security Council had not approved it. 2 years later, before he illegally invaded Iraq and changed its regime, Bush tried to obtain the consent of the Security Council, but the council refused to authorize his attack. So then Bush said, well, we have prior Security Council resolutions from the first Gulf War. Those would justify our attack in 2003. None of them authorized him to attack in 2003. So that